Tony Simpson, Ryan Champion and Jack Bennion.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally, episode 10, season 11. We got there in the end, didn't we? Here we are, our last one before our little sabbatical for 2 weeks. And we've got a little bit of a, as ever, a busy show. Lots of things coming up. We've got Petter Solberg coming up a little bit later on. We've got some other guests coming up a bit later on. What's nice is that the boys didn't even know that I'd done the Petter Solberg thing. Well, Ray kind of had an inkling I did. We've got Trevor Agger coming up, last part of this particular series of coaching. And yeah, and we're going to talk about Rally Corsica. But as ever, at the top of the show, I've got on my right, Jack Bennion. Hello, Jack Bennion.
Hello, Tony Simpson.
And on my left, I have Ryan Champion. Hello, Ryan Champion.
Hello, Jack Bennion and Tony Simpson.
We did, before we started, we always have our little chats. We did hair products the other week, and we did receding hairlines offer prior to this one. I think in some kind of organising, we go Jack Bennion, Ryan Champion, Tony Simpson, if anybody was interested. If you're not, that's fine, because it's about rallying anyway. It's not about hairlines and hair products. So there you go. Boys, it's Corsica this coming weekend. Now, as your any other business last week, Ryan, you were right on cue. You pointed out to our listeners that Thierry Neuville had an off, and I don't think anybody still quite figured out kind of how he ended up where he ended up, have they yet?
He slipped down a bank.
Oh, thanks, Jack. There you go. There you go. Right, don't go into anything more complicated. He slid down a bank,
but that still doesn't explain how he got under the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think we still got that. I still don't think we got that sort of Jack Bennion. You know, as a journalist, we thought you might have brought a little bit more to it as he slid off a bank.
Well, I'm expert in bluntness, aren't I, really, let's be honest.
Yeah, you are.
I think he's gone off. I think what's happened is he's gone off after the bridge and then rolled down the bank under the bridge. He's rolled backwards down the bank.
Right.
I mean, Jack Bennion has the answers to these sort of things, so I wouldn't argue with him.
Okay, that's fair dues. Fair dues. Are we excited about Corsica? I'll tell you what I'm more excited about Corsica. Right, and we spoke about it again, the smoke and mirrors thing. We've done the thing with Trev earlier today, which is at the end of the podcast. And of course, the co-drivers club and everything else, of course. Were we surprised that Phil Mills, and I know Phil quite well. I know Phil was obviously doing Elvin's gravel notes, alongside Gwyndaf. I'll come to you first. Right. Were you surprised that Phil decided to, or took the opportunity to fill the seat?
Well, I had a little bit of inside knowledge on this one, so I kind of did know it was, I knew it was coming. And when you think about it, obviously Phil's been doing Elvin's gravel notes now for a long time with Gwyndaf. And, so he knows his pace note system. He reads his pace notes for 3 days on every world championship. Well, not every world championship rally, but those that allow safety notes nowadays, gravel notes. So he's well used to his system. He's well used to reading the notes. There is quite a lot of sense in that. Having said that, it relied on Phil wanting to do it. It's 8 years since he's been at the front of a WRC event in a top line car. So, I guess he probably thought long and hard about actually whether he wanted to do it, but great to see him back. And, it'll be interesting to see how they get on.
Jack, quite interesting, really, the little piece that I'm assuming David wrote in the publication this week with regards to he's just more interested in basically meeting up with Seb and Daniel to join the old farts club, as he called it.
Yeah, very interesting quotes, but very typical of Phil as well, aren't they? And yeah, I think I'd agree with Ryan there. I think if there's anyone you want co-driving for you, it's a previous WRC champion who has been reading your notes for 5 years. So when you think about it, it's logical. Probably a bit of a surprise to some people, given, of all the co-drivers out there, Phil Mills on the outside of things seems like a bit of an odd choice. Phil's been away from the sport for a long time, and if he'd wanted to come back into it, he probably would have been able to quite easily. So maybe a bit of a surprise from that, from Phil Mills' side of things. But from Elvin, I think it's a very logical choice, and Phil should be able to hit the ground running after reading so many of Elvin's notes over the past years.
Right. What's quite funny, of course, is that later in the podcast, I did a piece last week with Petter Solberg, and I asked Petter whether it had whetted his appetite with regards to obviously seeing I think he's a lot closer to Seb Loeb these days. Obviously, their paths cross quite a bit, quite literally now in Rallycross. I think they spend quite a lot of time together with that particular circus, the travelling circus that is Wheel Rallycross. But apparently, he was in constant conversation with Sebastian Loeb, and Sebastian Loeb technically said pretty much what Phil Mills said, just to prove that there's still life and in the old dog yet. And, you know, maybe the old fart should come back, Petter included. And as you can imagine with Petter, he's more than up for it. I wonder if he'll come back with Phil.
Yeah, well, we often hear rumours of Petter trying to put something together, don't we, to come back and do a rally. So I wouldn't be surprised if Petter did something at some point. But, you know, it's not that long ago that Petter was obviously in top line WRC. I'm sure he would like to come back and create the waves that Sebastian Loeb has done. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm sure I wouldn't be surprised to see Petter come back as a one-off, but I can't see him coming back in a top line team for several rallies in the way that Loeb's done.
Well, you need to listen a bit later on in this podcast to what Petter has to say about putting something together to come back for Rally GB. I think you'll like it. I think you'll like it. And that's just a teaser, because the boys haven't heard it. I have, obviously I have, because I was the one talking to him. So there you go. So I'm not going to say more than that, boys. You need to tune into that one. But Jack, I'm going to come to you on this particular one. Some great facts and figures quoted this week in MM with regards to the golden era currently, which we're in for WRC. You know, comparisons of how many different winners we've had and things like that. It's quite an interesting piece.
Yeah, that's the 2-3 you're referring to, Tony, is it?
Yeah, that's it is, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit from Chris Meek from Malcolm Wilson on the current crop of WRC drivers and cars. A lot of Chris Meek referring to the current generation as being as good as any in the WRC's history. I'm sure that'll spark a lot of debate with MN readers, and I'm sure on this podcast as well. It's a very difficult debate that you can have about any sport if you're a football fan. Obviously, a lot of people make the link between the likes of Pelé and Maradona and Ronaldo and Messi. So you can go back into various parts of sports and try and work out who's the best. It's very difficult to do, but Chris is very, very complimentary of the current crop of drivers and believes that they're, you know, up there with the best, and has named some names like Colin McRae and Richard Burns as well. And Malcolm's also pointed out to the fact that the events are a little bit shorter and not quite as endurance based as they might have once been, but the competition is still very close together. So David's done a little bit of a piece on that, and brought some stats to the equation in terms of how close the competition actually is this year, which, you know, as we all know and we've spoken about a lot on the podcast, it's very close indeed.
Right, some interesting stats. I don't know whether you've had a chance to have a look at this yet, but would you agree we're back in this, you know, is this an era we're going to look back on in 10, 15, 20 years time? I suppose as we look back at kind of the mid to late 90s now and see it is one of those, you know, the halcyon days of rallying?
I think you've answered the question in your question. You look back on these things and decide then, don't you? For me, it's difficult to say you're going through a golden era currently. A lot of people wouldn't have seen the early Group A days as a golden era, but now people look back on them really warmly with the speed and the reference to the road cars, the fact that you could go and buy something similar in the local showroom. So people's views change on these things, and what is great is that we've got a very competitive WRC. We've got multiple teams that can win. We've got multiple drivers that can win, which from the outside certainly hasn't been like that for the last few years when you look at the list of world champions. So it's great that it is as open as it currently is, but I think we'll look back in a few years and make a decision on that one.
Do you know what, boy? I'm going to put this one to you. What was interesting when I was looking at those stats, I'll come to you first, Jack, of course, your hero, and it was made reference to the fact that we went through, you know, an incredibly lean period in WRC, and we've made reference to it before in this podcast. You know, without Citroën and Ford and M Sport, you know, if one of those would have went during that particular period where it was a Loeb domination with Marcus Grönholm, obviously, you know, trying to chase down Sebastian Loeb, I wonder where we'd be today with WRC. But did perhaps a little bit of what we've seen with Seb coming back on Mexico maybe quash some of those people that look back on that era and say, well, he didn't have any competition?
It's a very difficult one, isn't it? It's if you'd have asked me before Mexico if I thought the current crop was one of the best ever, then yeah, I'd have probably backed that argument, or I'd have thought very sort of, I would have taken a lot of thought before dismissing it anyway. And now, after kind of Logue's come back after being out for so long and just kind of been bang on the pace of these guys straight away, it's difficult to know whether, is that an indication of how unbelievably brilliant Sebastian Loeb is, or is it an indication that maybe the current crop isn't as good as we think it is, and the fact that they're all close together in shorter events is the kind of thing that's making it look more competitive than it maybe is. It's very difficult to work out, isn't it? And I'm really struggling to fall down either side. Obviously very complimentary of Loeb's abilities and watched him growing up, so you know, I'm probably a little bit sort of got the rose tinted spectacles out in that sense for Loeb a little bit, but you know, I think the current crop, as much as they are you know, all very brilliant drivers and the field is very competitive, I do believe it is being affected by the fact that the events are shorter and you know, the regulations are so tight. So yeah, it's a difficult one to work out, but you know, I think it's a bit of both of that sort of curtails the argument any at all.
I think you've even lost interest in towards the end of that answer then, didn't you, Jack?
Definitely not lost interest. I've got too much interest and can't really condense it into a coherent argument, really.
Well, it's like you were arguing with yourself. That's what I quite liked about it.
That's what these things are, though, aren't they? You know, the thing for me is, I don't think it's fair to compare the current drivers to, you know, drivers 20 or 30 years ago, because, for example, like if you're looking at the drivers who are coming through now, they've come through periods where, you know, there's so much more focus on the mind. There's so much more focus on the physical training side of things now, and we've got so many resources when it comes to training sportsmen these days that the drivers are going into the car far better prepared than they were 20 or 30 years ago. You know, back then they were having a fag and then getting into the stages, whereas now obviously things are a lot more strict. So you know, who knows, if you take someone like Sandro Minari from the 70s and give him today's training and put him in a 2017 car, you know, he might be better than everybody else and he might blow everyone away. He might be, you know, one of the most phenomenal driving talents you've ever seen, but without that preparation, you know, it's difficult to kind of analyze where they're at, isn't it? So it's always difficult to compare people from a current period to a previous period.
Do you know what? I agree about 90% of that, right, what Jack's just said. But there's one driver from that kind of late 90s period that I still think is at the professionalism. Maybe he was ahead of his time. Maybe this is going to be an unfair comparison. But Carlos Sainz is somebody that reminds me of perhaps somebody, maybe not quite today, but in the not too distant past, who could have still stepped in.
Well, Carlos definitely had an incredible work ethic, and if you speak to teams that ran him at the time, you know, he didn't leave any stone unturned. He was very determined. He wanted to get the best out of not only the car but everybody around him, all the mechanics. He was very driven and wasn't necessarily the fastest over one stage. I mean, often when he was testing with Colin, for example, Colin would be much quicker over the first pass, but eventually Carlos would match the time. But Carlos worked at it, and very much he had a professional approach. And if you want to go back a little bit further, you look at Walter Raw. You know, he was incredibly dedicated to the sport. He, as a lot of people will know, he had his rallies he liked, his rallies that he certainly disliked and didn't want to do. But his application at the time and his physical fitness, his mental preparation was certainly far above, you know, the people he was competing against. And, you know, to go to Monte Carlo, for example, and win it in three completely different cars in three successive years. He won it in a quattro, his first attempt. So, you know, there has been drivers with different styles, different applications over the years. But I think, you know, asking the chairman of the Sebastian Loeb fan club what he thinks about Sebastian Loeb, you're probably not going to get a straight answer, are you?
Well, no, I sensed that. That's why I kind of went to him first, because I thought, we're very early on the podcast. We've got a lot of time here that we can play with. That's why I let kind of Jack run with it, just to see where he'd go. And he basically went all the way out and then did a circle and then came right back on himself. It was quite nice. Quite nice.
Jack, glad I'm here for the comic relief.
I hasten to add, just comic relief, nothing else. We've got Trev talking about Corsica later in the podcast. Right. Have you been over on the island at all? Have you spent any time over there?
Yeah, I went over to a couple of the WRC rallies in the early 2000s. And funnily enough, I have quite a strange memory of Corsica. I was stood in a stage with a camera crew waiting for car number one to come through. The zero car had been through whatever it was 15 minutes before, side of a mountain. Could hear a noise coming in the distance. Didn't sound like a World Rally car. And sure enough, there was whatever it was a Fiat Cinquecento or something, driving the wrong way down the stage. And it was actually the zero car. And there'd been a delay at the start of the stage, and it was so far round, rather than send the zero car round by the road, they sent him the wrong way through the stage again.
Wow.
It was just a surprise at the time.
So the safety car went the wrong way up the stage.
So they'd run him through as normal, and then the first car had been delayed, so they sent the zero car back to the start again, through the stage.
There you go. Let's not even go there. I've been over on the event once, and it was the S14 was the hatchback, wasn't it? Right.
Yeah, it was.
That was the first hatch. I was over with Pro Drive doing some stuff with Pro Drive and with M Sport on that one. I seem to remember Andreas being run by Ram Sport on it as well, and Suzuki were there. It was the year of Suzuki. So what would that have been? 2008. That would have been around then, wouldn't it? And it's just one of those. I said it when I was talking to Gus the other week. Just one of those rallies that when you drive the stages. And you think I would just not because I thought I'd be competitive, but I would just love to do this rally. And what's interesting, and the reason why I'm going to ask you about this, because you've been on the island, is that I said the same to Trev at the end, and obviously he's gone over there competitively and everything else, and it's not one that he enjoyed. He didn't find the tarmac rounds enjoyable, especially tarmac rounds like that. I'll let Trev explain later in the podcast to our listeners, but he said it wasn't one of his more enjoyable events.
There's a couple of things, isn't it? I mean, the stages are very unique, very demanding, very twisty, as we know, and it is very much corner, but it is also a dangerous place, isn't it? Let's not forget that. You know, we lost a couple of the WRC stars back in the day, of Tio Bettiger in 85 and obviously Henry Toivonen in 86. So it's not been without its accidents. And then we've seen the likes of Colin McRae have two bad accidents there. Tommy Mäkinen have a couple of bad accidents. So it is, you know, it's an event that certainly isn't without its risks, that's for sure.
Jack, have you caught a little bit of sun over there and did a bit of speccying?
Nope, I've never been to Corsica. I would like to go. Hopefully, one time in the future, I'll be able to get out there.
Do it. Just stay out of the Privy Club. I had a message the other day. You know, one of these time hop things where something comes up, and it was Simon Hughes. And for those of you who don't know who Simon was a very, very quick young man back in the day in a Clio Super 1600. They did the Fiesta World Series and everything else. Anyway, me and Simon were out there working, we ended up in a nightclub, which we shouldn't have done. And we were lucky to get out alive. And that's our memories of being on Corsica. And he sent me an image of us in a, anyway. I'm not going to say any more than that because his missus might be listening and mine might be listening. So we'll quickly move on. right, moving forward, boys. It is Corsica this coming weekend. Road order and things like that are not really going to come into it, Jack, but obviously Loeb is still back there, or he's back there this time round. We're not going to see another Rally Mexico, are we?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I think I don't think many people predicted that or actually believed in their heart of hearts that Sebastian was going to be as quick as he was in Mexico. I for one was expected him to be kind of top five, but challenging for the win seemed to be a bit out of the question. And then, you know, the event happened and he was very much doing that, wasn't he? And the thing about Corsica is obviously the surface is even. It's an event that he knows and has done before, an event that he's won every stage on in one instance in 2005, and somewhere he's gone very well before. So to rule him out after his performance in Mexico would be a bit silly, I think. Saying that, Chris went very well there last year in that car and has experience experience of that car on the event. So he'll be one to watch. And supposedly Ford are going to be a lot better off than they were last year. Some words from Chris Williams in this week's MN explaining that. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting fight. And we know Thierry is always quick on tarmac as well. So we've got a lot of runners in there. Chris Meek points to the fact that, you know, around 60% of the route is new, so that'll help Sebastian Loeb. Obviously, all the drivers will be learning the route as that part of the route anyway as they go. So, I think Sebastian is going to be definitely there or thereabouts on pace for sure.
Brian Champion, are we going to be in one of these situations where have we got a level expectancy now for Loeb, or will there be a leveling off of perhaps he'll be where he kind of were? Most people thought he would be, if that makes sense.
No, I think he'd be very competitive. I think obviously we never seem to know how competitive a Citroen's going to be when it turns up on a rally. But if there's any rally where we expect it to be competitive, it's got to be Corsica. So I think the car will go very well. It'll be interesting actually to see the inter-team battle really between Sebastian Loeb and Chris Meek, because they, you know, like I said, if the car's going to work anywhere, it's going to work there. Chris has the experience of the car, knows Corsica well. But as we've already said, we expect Loeb to he'll make a good set of pace notes and he'll be bang on the pace. So I think it'll be a close battle between them, and I think they'll be right at the sharp end of the field.
Jack, obviously we've mentioned Thierry at the top. Hyundai have gone well on tarmac as well. Are we going to see perhaps a change of the guard? Maybe, you know, I tipped Andreas very very early on with regards to being kind of on the pace. He still hasn't quite kind of hit that kind of sweet spot. Yeah, I've just mentioned before, of course, I remember seeing Andreas back in 2008, which seems bizarre to think that's 10 years ago now. Are we going to see something perhaps, you know, from Hyundai, maybe from Andreas on this particular event?
I think if we've learned anything from the past year, really, it's that it's almost impossible. Well, especially if you're on absolute rally, you definitely can't predict who's going to win the rally then.
No, that's a fair point.
But anyone generally has struggled to kind of predict the winners. The thing with Corsica, obviously, is that we've got an even surface, so it does even things out a little bit. But, you know, we've got a lot of people to look at, haven't we? And that's what's, you know, maybe the kind of underlying tone of the, you know, the 2-3 and MN this week that we discussed earlier. The competition is so high. We've got so many drivers who are, you know, fairly equal on pace, and you know, Mickelson, we mentioned Thierry. We've got Brian Bouffier, who's won the event before for M Sport back. Interestingly, with Xavier Panseri, the co-driver who stepped in for him when his previous co-driver was injured in Dakar. So that's interesting. He's kept him on. The other hand, I've got Danny Sordo, who went really well in Mexico and surely feeling a bit confident after his performance on that event, even though it was gravel, back on tarmac, which maybe might suit him a little bit better. And then you've got the three Toyotas. It's really difficult to kind of pick who, even on any given weekend, who's going to be the top driver in their team, never mind who's going to be the top driver over the course of a weekend. So in answer to your question, I think Thierry and Andreas will be very quick, but I think it's going to be... I think a lot of the teams are going to improve on where they sort of were a little bit poorer last year, and it's going to bring things a little bit closer together.
Right. Are we being, am I being a little bit dismissive perhaps of you know, we've spoke about the Citroen, we've spoke about Hyundai, you know, Jack's mentioned the Fords. We've not really mentioned, of course, the Toyotas, and, you know, are we being dismissive of their tarmac pace or their abilities?
We didn't expect the Toyota to go particularly well on tarmac last year, and of course it did. Monte Carlo was very mixed surface this year, but the car was very competitive in Monte Carlo. So, you know, we should expect them to be very quick. I guess we don't see their driver lineup primarily as a tarmac lineup, despite the fact they've all produced amazing results on tarmac and taken amazing wins on tarmac. So, I don't think we can rule them out. But I still think that the winner will come from one of the other teams, probably not from Toyota on this occasion. But I could be wrong.
we could all be wrong, and there could be somebody in WRC2 that wins it overall, which I know is a big call. But no, WRC2, by the way, but in fact, all the classes, of course, we've got JWRC back out as well. But WRC2 just looks mega. Of course, we've got our own friend of the show, Gus Greensmith, in WRC2. He's running a little bit further down. I think he's running non-priority on this particular event. But, you know, we've got the Japanese drivers back, of course, in the Tommy Mäkinen racing cars. And, I think it's going to be fascinating, because obviously Skoda Motorsport have got their boys back out as well. I'm just looking at the entry list now. Jan Kopecky obviously has always gone very, very quick on tarmac. He is kind of their go-to man for these type of events. But Takamoto and Aroki Arai, I'm looking at them now. And I think, is it fair to say that perhaps very early on, nobody kind of seen them as a threat? And it was more of a token gesture. But all of a sudden, I think this, you know, what Takamoto Kasuta did on Sweden, everybody's kind of went, oh, hang on a minute, this is serious.
Well, they spent most of their early rallies rolling them into the ditches, didn't they? So it's to start with, they didn't do particularly well, especially when they sort of hit the RC and I remember Katsuta rolling 3 or 4 times in one event. It's been a baptism of fire for them.
Have you seen who's the latest testing accident in Corsica was?
No.
Katsuta.
There we go. The interesting thing in answer to your question, Tony, might be that Takamoto's got a lot of experience in circuit racing, so maybe the tarmac will come a little bit more naturally to him than maybe gravel and snow did to start with. But yeah, it seemed like Sweden was a bit of a breakthrough for him, didn't it? And he obviously went very well there. I think the tyres played into that a little bit in WRC2. Pirellis are obviously working very, very well in Sweden, and the Michelins and the D-Max not so much. So I think tyres did play a little part in it, but I think Takamoto has definitely made a bit of a breakthrough. For me, I'm not particularly excited about WRC2, to be honest, and compared to previously. I think, you know, we've been spoiled over the past few years, where we've had Ezepeka and Elvin and Pontus Tiedemann, and then it comes to Korsika, and, you know, you're kind of looking at Jan Kopecky, who's, you know, always been very, very quick, but never quite, you know, that sort of top line WRC level in my opinion anyway. We have got some very quick French lads out there, which should sort of make it exciting. It'll be interesting to see where they come in, and we've got Stefan Lefebvre in the new C3, so that'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Well, I was literally just about to say that, and that's Ryan Champion sending you the picture of the accident, by the way, in case you're wondering what that beep was. I was just looking there. You see, I go with you to a point, but one of your favourite drivers is in WRC2. One of your big tips, I think it was last year, Norwegian.
Ole Christian, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he'd be a good shout for the championship this year. It depends on how much Tiedemann actually completes of the year. I think Ole's been getting a lot quicker, and he's been doing some. He did a Czech rally with Kopecky last weekend just to improve his tarmac pace ready for this event. So tarmac's something that's not natural to him, as you would probably expect for a Scandinavian, but he's been sort of working on that a little bit recently. And I think depending on how much Tiedemann does, he'll be one to watch. But it's not, you know, I'm not saying there's not good drivers in the field. It's just, I think the competition in the past few years has been better in WRC2 than it is this year. And when you've got Tiedemann missing, it's difficult to see out of those drivers, you know, which one of those. Well, here's the question: apart from Lefebvre, who's obviously done WRC before, which one of those drivers slots straight into a WRC seat? And for me, it's none of them at the minute. So I think we've got a little bit of a gap where we've been spoilt with talent, and then we've got, you know, some of the other guys coming through now, and, you know, hopefully in the next couple of years, those guys are going to take it up to that next level.
Do you know what, Jack? I can't believe that there isn't another RGT entry from a certain Yorkshireman on this particular event.
it'd be very nice to see Ryan in a Porsche. We've talked about it quite a lot. He's a few quid short at the minute. He needs to rob a few more. No, I'm not going to say that on the radio.
No, of course not. Ryan Champion, tongue in cheek, joking aside, that there's one Porsche out in the RGTs. Why do you think, and you've been quite vocal with regards to obviously getting some of these cars obviously to run in the UK as well, why do you think that the uptake on this at WRC level just hasn't really happened?
At WRC level, a good question. I think
it's probably the best RGT entry ever, isn't it, this event, by the way?
Yeah, probably, with several Porsches and quite a few others.
There's seven altogether.
I think maybe
there's only two registered though, isn't there?
I'm not sure about registered actually. There's definitely three Porsches and four Abarths. But I guess it's difficult to. I mean, the Abarth's not anywhere near as spectacular or loud or magical as the Porsche, really.
No, it's not. Go on, Jack. Go on, Ryan.
Well, to go back to your question, I just think that current WRC rallies don't fit very well with, for want of a better description, gentleman drivers. It takes a long time to do a current WRC rally for very little mileage comparatively. It's a big cost undertaking. And there's probably more fun events elsewhere, dare I say it. Yes, there's still it's still the pinnacle of the sport, but like I said, there's an awful lot of waiting around. You're at the event for over a week, and a lot of these people who are funding their own motorsport do it for fun, but they still have businesses to run as well. So I just wonder if, like I said, WRC doesn't fit the gentleman driver profile.
Okay. Boys, as I say, we've got 2 weeks off after this, so technically everybody can forget about predictions. But before I move on to some other bits and pieces I want to do, are we even going to bother with predictions, or should we just screw up the piece of paper, throw it in the bin, and just see what happens?
I think we should predict it, because I think the listeners like to laugh at us when we get it wrong.
Okay, fair dues. Jack, you spoke up first. Go on.
Oh, good. Thanks very much. should I do it? You know what I'm debating, don't you?
Yeah. Yes, I do. Yeah.
Everyone knows, don't they? So it'd be a bit boring if I said it. All right. I think Thierry Neuville's going to win.
Thierry. Ryan Champion?
Yep, that was my tip as well, Thierry Neuville.
Are you going Thierry as well? Okay. Yeah. Fair dues. I'm going to go left field to the extent where I'm going to go to a four-time world champion. Five-time world champion now, isn't he? Sorry. I want to go Ogier.
That's fair, but everyone knows that the best preparation for a rally is putting it down a bank and under a bridge.
Yeah, of course. That's an absolute no-brainer. Of course it is.
So listen, that's the logic.
Listen, boys, I have got, before we move away from Corsica to any other business, I have got, as ever with Gary Boyd, Gary always sends us something in. And this is more of what, do you know what, I was going to just read it out, and then I thought, you know what, this is going to be great to ask Ryan Champion and Jack Benyon. You can actually combine on this one. Right, a piece of rally trivia. Rally Corsica marks a quarter of a century since the last time a WRC event had all three podium steps filled by drivers of the host country. Tour de Corse, 1993. Who are the three drivers? First, second, third.
Oh, that's a good in. That's a good in. Delacour won in 93.
Yeah, I think Delacour won.
That's correct.
Obviously, I know who's second as well. Didier Auriol. Cool.
Yeah.
In the Toyota.
Yeah. Who's the third driver?
Now.
Is it Chatrio?
Can you give me a first name?
Francois.
Correct.
In the other Toyota, the Castrol car.
There you go, Brian. You didn't even get a chance to draw breath.
I didn't, no.
that's my couple of years though. The couple.
Wow.
Of 90s.
Do you know what? That is mighty impressive.
I did do a little bit. You will understand why I knew a little bit more about that than I probably should have done, because I did a little bit of research for my own other business that kind of cropped me over that sort of early period there. So that might come a bit more apparent later on in the podcast.
Okay. Is there anything else, boys, before we get to our any other businesses that we want to get off our chest, or should we go straight to any other business? Because believe it or not, we have been waffling on now for 33 minutes.
No, other than there was another testing accident, and that was Demervius in R5-208 as well. So there's been three fairly sizable pre-Corsica testing accidents.
If you're listening in Ireland, there's quite a good Irish representation this weekend in Callum Devine, who's doing the Junior World Rally Championship, who won the Junior British Championship last year. And he's doing the same championship that Tom Williams, who we've talked about a lot and had on the show, is doing as well. And that entry is really cool, actually. There's some really cool drivers doing the Junior WRC. But also 1982 Irish Tarmac champion John Coyne, who's now based in America, is driving one of the Porsche RGTs that we talked about. So he's done quite a few events over the last year. Did Donegal in the car last year and things like that. So he's gone over to do Corsica to take that off the bucket list.
There you go. There you go.
To bring to below zero to perfect his 911 skills.
And who was his instructor?
Actually, Terry Kirby.
That was a plug.
What was really ironic was I thought it was going to be Ryan Champion, is it? Of course, and you could have said Ryan Champion, and we wouldn't have known any difference.
Looking after another group that day, but John really enjoyed his trip to the ice, and he's loving his. He's come back to rallying. Still has his. He's bought back his original Talbot Sunbeam Lotus that he won the Irish Tarmac Championship in. He's been doing some historic rallies in that, and he's loving his RGT 911 as I'm sure any of us would.
As you do. Is there any other business Corsica related, Jack Bennion, by any chance?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll keep theme because mine's away from Corsica. So we'll go with yours.
Okay. In terms of wins in Corsica in the WRC, there's the two drivers who've won the most are tied with six. But do either of you know which one I'm going to talk about?
Well, probably not Didier Auriol on that basis, I guess.
Yes, of course I'm going to talk about Didier Auriol. I like him even more than I like Sebastian Loeb.
Right, okay then. Did you know he had a donkey?
Did I know what, sorry?
Actually, do you know what? I know that story. Have you told me that story?
He's got two donkeys. Oh, he did have?
Yeah.
I don't know if he still has, but yeah.
I'm sure you told me that story, because you can't have one donkey, can you?
Well,
we've had this conversation.
He can, but it was lonely, so he got on.
Yeah.
Right, I'll come to that in a minute. I want to go back Bennion's thunder.
Well, I don't really want to do my business anymore, because it's definitely not as good as knowing the fact that Didier Auriol's got two donkeys, which I didn't know.
Well, when Didier Auriol won the World Rally Championship, he, if you remember, on his overalls, he used to have a badge of Milau, the town where he's from, the famous bridge, the Milau Bridge. And so he was sponsored by the local town, and the local mayor held a civic reception for him when he won the WRC. And as a gift from the town for winning the WRC, they presented him with a donkey.
Obviously.
Now, Didier Auriol had never really thought he wanted a donkey, but anyway, he got this donkey, but his family decided it did look very sad in the field on its own, so they ended up with a second donkey, and then Didier Auriol had two donkeys. And I know that story's true, because he told me himself. So, there you are.
And little did you know, well, Jack Bennion and I know this, but listeners, Ryan Champion has donkeys, so he's a bit of an aficionado, not only on Group A cars, which I'm sure he could have talked to Francois Delacour and Didier Auriol about, if indeed that's what he does with Frenchmen. But he could have talked donkeys with them as well. So there you go. Is that your any other business? Sorry,
I'm giving up. I'm waving the white flag.
No, Jack Bennion, go on, take it away.
There wasn't much to add, although I was just going to run down some of the events that he won. Like 88 was particularly impressive when he won in the Sierra Cosworth. He surprised Lancia that much on that event, I think, that they decided to sign him up for the next year. And then he went on to win six altogether. So that was pretty much it, and sounds really terrible, no?
Not as interesting as donkeys,
is
it?
He's got another record for wins. Do we know what that might be? There's another event that he holds the most number of wins for, and he doesn't even hold it for Corsica, he's joint, but he does actually hold a record for another event.
Ryan?
I'd be guessing. I'm scratching my head off one at the minute.
Race champions.
Oh.
Okay.
Won four race champions.
Okay. There you go. It comes to my any other business. My any other business is dead easy this week. Because it's our final episode of this particular season, and we have run unliveried, but lots of people have shown us love and support and everything else. We have appreciated it. We have got another season left unliveried. After that, it's going to be hard. That's all I'm going to say. But for those who've supported us so far, we got our hands on another copy of Dirt 4. Now, if you've already got Dirt 4, that's fine. If you haven't got Dirt 4, all you got to do is send us an email to studio@absoluterally.co.uk, and we'll pick a winner out and we'll send you this. And we may even, if you're that arsed, and I can't say that word, if you're that arsed, I may even get the boys to sign it if you really want it signed. There you go. That's what I'm prepared to do for my new other business this week. Anyway, swiftly moving on. Boys, that's the end of this particular section.
What about Ryan's any other business?
I thought Ryan done his.
Well, it turned into donkeys, didn't it?
turned into the aerial, but I'm sure he had something else to say.
Have you got something else to say, Ryan?
No, I mean, mine just went, funnily enough, mine was along similar lines to Jack's, and just looking back a little bit at the history of the Tour de Corse, really, because it's obviously been a part of WRC history for a long, long time. It dropped out of WRC for a few years when Rally de France in Alsace took over, and then once the local government backing from Alsace dropped away with Sebastian Loeb, funnily enough, then Corsica's come back. And like I said, for a few years there was talk that Corsica was too dangerous to run in a championship, but I guess they pay quite a lot of attention to which roads they run now and which sections of stages. But as Jack's already alluded to, you know, there's been some specialist winners over the years, really, with Corsica that we've not seen elsewhere. I mean, famously, Jean Magnotti won it a couple of times in the Renault 5 Turbo, as we've already touched on, Didier Auriol in the Sierra. But there was the famous 1987 victory by Bernard Begouin in the Pro Drive M3, which I think a lot of people have great memories of the Rothmans M3 from that year. And I just touched on Colin McRae earlier. Colin had two sizable accidents in the Focus in 2000 and 2002. But before that, he was pretty successful there with good results in 97 and 98 when he took victories in the Subaru. Tony Pond had a podium there right back in 1981 in a Datsun Violet, and followed it up with, I think it was a fifth place finish with a 240 RS a little bit later on. And one man we haven't really talked about in the run-up to, we did touch on him, but not in terms of his hopes for the rally. But of course, Elvin Evans took a fantastic second place in 2015, and in 2016, he also won WRC2 there, beating the likes of Jan Kopecky. We know always goes very well on tarmac. So let's see how he gets on. Hopefully, him and Phil can bond very quickly together, and let's hope he's right in the mix for a good result, because he needs one, as we all know, with his tough start to the season.
Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more, folks. By all means, I like the way you are getting involved with us a little bit more on Twitter, by the way. And by all means, put us straight. Let us know what your thoughts are on you know, the winners and riders and everything else. Just a bit of a rundown. The boys went for Thierry. I went for Sebastien Ogier. So we've gave them effectively the chances of them winning now are zero. So please don't put any money on them. And yeah, there you go. There you go. Boys, we've got 2 weeks off. Have you got anything exciting happening, Ryan Champion?
I'm working away again, so I head to Ibiza on Saturday for
DJ Ryan Champion.
Yes, yeah, back to the DJ, and yep, that's it.
Jack Banging.
I have a very busy weekend on autosport.com coming up, and then the weekend after, I'm going to check out what this Rally Tendring and Clacton is all about in Essex, which I'm very much looking forward to. The first event. Ooh. Run under the closed road stages, the new laws that have been passed. So, very interested to see how that goes, and yeah, look forward to writing a little bit about that the week after.
Okay, I look forward to speaking to you about that. We can talk about that on the podcast as well. Folks, we're going to go to a little break, and then we're going to come back with Petter Solberg.
You're listening to Absolute Rally. Get all the latest updates by following us on Twitter at @absolute_rally.
And welcome back to Absolute Rally. And I apologise first and foremost for the next section. We got Petter Solberg on, and it was great to get Petter, but it was very cup and string. We had to kind of dial into a system and everything else, but anyway, not the way we normally record. So I apologize if the levels are not great. I'm sure Alistair, our producer, has done wonderful things with the recording, but even so, I've given him a very, very difficult job. Just a little bit of a heads up with regards to what we were talking to Petter about initially. Obviously, we wanted to talk to him about rallying, but he's involved in this Road to Gym Carna grid, which will air on 7 p.m. on Saturday the 14th of April on Insight TV, which is Sky Channel in the UK at 5:64. I have seen it. It is really, really interesting. I love motorsport documentaries anyway, but yeah, it gives a true flavour of of many different people who are involved in Gymkhana, which has become very much a sport in its own right now. And obviously Ken Block's heavily involved, and he talks about how it came about and everything else. So anyway, seek it out, folks. Enjoy it. As I said, we pinched some time with Petter. We probably should have done more on the road to Gymkhana, but of course we're a rally podcast. I wanted to talk to him about rallying. So without further ado, let's get to Petter Solberg. I wanted to first and foremost ask you, we've been very lucky to be sent obviously the preview of the road to Gymkhana grid. I think there's something quite special now about just the name Petter. I don't even think we need to say Solberg anymore. I think Petter now just kind of just transcends, you know, I know you from rally and that's my passion. And yet you've obviously, rallycross was where you began, then you came to rally, now you're back in rallycross. And here we find you in Gymkhana, and just the name Petter, instantly people now think of you. You know, it must be a unique experience for you these days that so many different people in different aspects of motorsport know you.
Well, I'm a bit, you know, it's something you never think about. You know, you're living a dream, doing different type of sports, getting the success and enjoying everything. So I think from rally, where my big passion is, rallycross with a quite new sport, have grown very quickly, and also together with the Gymkhana grid, that's been actually a huge success and very, very different compared with all the sports we are doing for all the other drivers. You know, it makes it, of course, good fun, but I like to do challenges like that and meet a lot of people and all about the passion end of the day when you do things.
I think it's perfect for you, because I still, you know, I'm a rally fan and I grew up watching you when you were first with M Sport and then Latvi Pro Drive, and of course the Hollywood name, that's where it all came from. I know Phil quite well, of course, who sat with you, so I've heard some of the stories, not for broadcast, it's fair to say, but you know, this just sums up the Hollywood, it's like bringing Hollywood back again, isn't it?
Yeah, I think after all the fans have said over the years, and I think there's been all the action, you know, when it goes well, I know a lot will happen, and when it goes shit, you know, then I'm shitty. So it's basically, the whole thing is all about, I'm so much involved in the result and with the car, and you can read me at the open book when it's about that, and rallycross itself, you know, it is a show sport, it's an action sport, and a lot of emotion in a very short time, and I think that's also what a lot of the people and fans enjoy, you know, and there's a lot of things happening all the time, so. But this is the thing for me, and also with Sebastian Loeb, you know, why he also enjoys it, is because it's so much going on straight away, and close to the fans, and it's easy for them to come close to us, you know.
Petter, I've got to ask you, what were your thoughts about Rally Mexico and Mr. Loeb, who you've just mentioned? Did you see that coming?
I talked to Loeb before the race and under the race also. And for me, it's the strategy what they have done. You know, he did a lot of homework before the race. He did a lot of testing. And with that starting position in Mexico, it makes it really good for him. So if you do a very good first day, for sure you will have a good second day and third day. So my expectation with him was actually top three, because you will never forget driving. But without the puncture, I think he would have been second. So at the end of the day, it was a fantastic job. It just tells you that. Like Loeb sent me a message, Petter, we are not too old yet, you know, we can still continue.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You know, we know your commitments with these other things, obviously, that we're talking about. Obviously, now the Gymkhana and World Rallycross, etc. But has it whetted the appetite seeing Seb come back and still be competitive?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I've done some testing besides, so I know a little bit where I'm standing myself. But at the end of the day, it has to be really good prepared and a plan behind it, and he has for sure sitting with him, and we had some discussion also with Volkswagen to take one of the cars to try to maybe do it, borrow a car from them and run it ourselves in one way, but it was very difficult to do it because they have actually stopped completely. So it's been in my mind. We have tried a little bit, but the main focus now is Rallycross, and of course the Gymkhana at the end of the year at a really good fun event. So I think it's enough. And also with Oliver driving now, you know, it's quite a lot going on, so he also takes a lot of time.
Well, I was just about to say, obviously we've got junior Solbergs now coming through, haven't we? We've got a new generation of Solbergs coming through. How has it been? I've got a 5-month-old son, and I'm desperate for him. You know, I've competed for 20 years myself, and I'm desperate for him to go into it. How would you cope? You know, I'll be honest with you, I'm still nervous picking up my son. How would you cope watching yours?
That is a big problem. It's very nerve-wracking. In rallycross, not too bad when he's driving with my car, because at least I can see him on the track. But when he's doing rally and not seeing him at all and just look at the stage times, you know, then that is even worse. But you know, I try to push my son into ice hockey or football or anything else, and then try all different sports, tennis, but he's passionate so much about motorsport. And
I wonder why that is, Petter.
I wonder also. And his big dream is to drive Rally GB this year. You know, that's his biggest dream, you know, to try to do the race there, where I have been doing a lot of success. And so we're looking into it to see if we can drive together. I drive one car and he drives one car in Rally GB, who's a very important race for us, basically, for history.
Wow, I'd love to see it. Genuinely, I keep everything crossed for you. But before we go, obviously this the premiere for the Road to Gymkhana grid is out on the 14th. What other commitments have you got towards doing that now?
Well, the thing is, I think the Gymkhana, you know, the job they have done and with the filming and stuff is incredible. I think they have made a really good atmosphere out of it to involve, you know, not just the professional drivers. And stuff they have taken with a lot of the wide audience out of it, and I think this is making the Gymkhana grid makes you know, like bringing people together and showing the passion behind the scenes from the people involved, and let people see that. I think it's incredible, so I'm really looking forward to that coming out, and the people have been involved in it. From the people I've been working with around it, it's been very professional. So, and I've done it with passion again, and then we always give more out of ourselves when they do that. So I hope that will be a big success, and also a big thing for promotion wise also before the next Gymkhana.
Fantastic. Petter, listen, from a very selfish point of view, because we are a rally podcast, I genuinely, genuinely hope we see you in a rally car on Rally GB with your boy. I think it would be an amazing story. And if we could get you back maybe around that time again to talk about it, I'd really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, if they're making a historic class, they will come with the escort. maybe R5, or if everything should... if it should be really good, you know, it's with the WRC 5.
I'm sure.
Can't take it as it comes.
I'm sure a certain workshop in Newtown could find your historic car quite easily enough.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, I think, like, you know, they were really involved now in this thing all around in the Rally GB. Also, you know, it can. A lot of things can happen, so I'm looking forward to that.
Brilliant. Listen, Petter, thank you so much for your time. I know you're very busy, you're testing and stuff. Very best of luck for your season with the team, of course, with Volkswagen, and we'll catch up with you again soon.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Petter.
You're listening to Absolute Rally. Get all the latest updates by following us on Twitter at @Absolute_Rally.
Welcome back to the final section of Absolute Rally, final section of this particular season as well. I hope you've enjoyed the season so far. I've probably banged on about it completely throughout the podcast, but it was nice to get through the 10 episodes. Obviously, we're going to have a little break for a couple of weeks after this one, but we're still right in the midst, of course, of our coaching section, which we've been doing with Trevor Agnew, and we're now up to, I call it syllabus, I call it category. I'm just going to call it number 6 because it was number 6 on the list. Trev, hello.
Hello, how are you?
We're all right. It's as I say, we're getting ready for our 2 week break. It's quite nice. The stresses and strains are pulling all this together.
Those 10 have gone really quickly, haven't they? Flown in.
They have. And it's been a weird old one because I had, as ever, when I do these things, I always have a plan of what I want to try and do and what I'm trying to achieve. And invariably what ends up happening, they don't end up becoming anything like I planned. and they just kind of form and morph into what they'll be. But this one's been good. Obviously we've got Petter Solberg that was on before us, which was nice having Petter with us. Petter did the very, very first podcast I did. So having Petter on this week has been really good as well. And yeah, hopefully we'll get him on again soon. And if he can pull that plan off that he talked about of having a two-car team in Rally GB with him and his son, I think it'll be a great story. Anyway, you didn't even know about that, did you, Trev? There you go.
All new.
There you go. So yeah, so Petter's on before us anyway. Right, but we are up to the sixth part of the coaching. We've broke it down into 10 sections to make life easy a little bit for me, I guess, when I was planning this. But we're up to now, how much will it cost? And what are you willing to sacrifice? Which I suppose should go hand in hand.
Yeah, two things there. People need to talk about how much will it cost. People think of transaction costs and monetary values. But for me, it's more important around what you're hoping to sacrifice. You know, what will cost you in your life? So it's a better way of gauging the value and actually achieving whatever it is you want to achieve. You know, and everybody's got their own spin on that. You know, you've certainly seen plenty of people over the years who have sacrificed a hell of a lot and completely changed their lifestyles. The one I remember is Michael Schumacher. Once he got a couple of years into what he did, he used to head off to Norway for the winter time and bring his entourage with him, so his dietitian and his fitness people. And he spent the winter in Norway fitness training. His thinking was that he couldn't get totally fit when the racing season was on. So he thought if he could arrive at the Australian Grand Prix 25% fitter than he could be for the rest of the season, he would have a head start on everybody else, you know. And he put a lot of work in over the winter doing that, whereas if you remember, his teammate Eddie Irvine probably headed off to Florida, and he certainly wouldn't have been 25% fitter when he arrived at the first Grand Prix. So straight away, your teammate, you've got that psychological and physical advantage straight away. But that's a hell of a sacrifice to take your family and go and do that. And I'm sure he made it fun the way he did it. But those are the sorts of sacrifices that have to happen if you want to be the absolute best, not just in the world, but in a lifetime, I suppose. And there are people like that. In football, you're the same. You know, like of Alex Ferguson, manager of Manchester United. You know, at the end of any Premiership win, the triple in particular, I remember I just heard a couple of interviews of players who were under him at that time, and they were saying, like, at the end of that, literally the day after the final whistle went, he's planning for the next season. So there's not that much time to enjoy it. It's all totally focused and pushing on with what you're going to do. Roy Keane, I remember him walking off the field, winning 4-0 and having a go at his players for not playing hard enough. And sometimes, you know, that win at all cost attitude, we've seen it in motorsport, of course, with people driving into each other to get an advantage. And I'll not need to go into the details of those. But that win at all cost attitude is not something that I had. I certainly want to succeed. I want to be a world champion. But I enjoyed my life as well. And it's getting that balance right, Tony, and seeing the value in what you're doing. And the achievement that you get, and I always remember when I won anything in motorsport, it was a great feeling. And even, you know, in Corsica in 2003, when we eventually got our ultimate goal, when you get it, there is a great high at the time, but it's nowhere near the lows you get through. And the lows in our sport are certainly a lot worse than the highs, you know. If you know what I mean, the lows are worse. If you go off a baseline, the lows really go through the floor. And horrible, horrible feeling. Whereas the highs, you think, okay, won that, what'll go do next?
Well, it's you know what, there's this thing, isn't it, that I don't know whether it's happened at the level that obviously you've just talked about winning Corsica and stuff like that, but I can certainly relate to you get the rally come down, you know, a couple of days after a rally, because your adrenaline is being so high, you get that come down. And it was probably a lot more when I was younger, when I think back now, because life just kind of kicks on. But you kind of have that thing of you know, you'd be on this massive high, and then you go back into, you know, real world, I suppose, real life on the Monday, and you'd be like, this is, you know, you'd be so downhearted. You're like, God, this is back to the dregs and you know, after living that life almost of for 24 hours of, like, you know, I'm a rally driver, or whatever it may be. And, yeah. And then, so I can't imagine what it must be like falling off a cliff edge when you've been doing it, like Corsica and places like that.
Yeah. Well, it's even, I remember in New Zealand when I was over at Neil Wearden in the 206, and that was a big thing. So most of our year was planned. That was the event we were going to have a go on, because we knew we'd have a good road position the first day. And it's the usual thing that goes into it. You have to have a bit of seat time beforehand. So we used Finland to get as much seat time as possible going into that rally, with Richard Burns and Robert Reed's help, you know, and everything was set up wonderfully, and you go off and you go on the first stage, and we ran behind Possum Bourne, and Richard told us at the time, if you can get anywhere at Possum on that first stage or on the first day, he says you'll be going somewhere, because he knows the event inside out. So we ran behind him, and first stage we beat him, we were ninth quickest. Second stage beat him, we were seventh quickest. Third stage beat him, we were fifth quickest. And the next stage we had a problem with the fuel pressure. I think what happened is the car ran out of fuel. It was that year, hopefully you probably remember, there were a few cars running out of fuel. So that was it. That's an 11-day trip, plus also all the year planning, plus all the effort goes into it. And it just goes down the tube like that. And you're away for 11 days. You come home after that. I called it a rally hangover, exactly what you were referring to before. And you just don't really want to talk for a couple of days. Whereas the flip side of it is, my partner at the time, my wife now, of course, I've been away for 11 days, and she wants to find out all about it and tell me what happened in 11 days. And yeah, it's a difficult one. As I said, the lows are always worse than the highest highs.
Most definitely, most definitely. But the sacrifice, you know, as you said, you know, most people do think of, there is always going to be a financial sacrifice when you're starting out. And obviously you've just talked about the family sacrifice there as well, which, you know, obviously Schumacher dragged his family, I wouldn't imagine kicking and screaming, but dragged his family over to Norway to continue, you know, improving his fitness and things like that. That is one of those dilemmas, isn't it, where I guess when you're starting out, you know, having a partner that can support you in what you're doing is invaluable, really. You know, I've been very lucky over the years that later in life I've had a very supportive partner, but, you know, certainly there was times when I first started and I didn't, and it was very difficult. And I kind of made a decision that I was going to go rallying, and that was it. And, you know, that pretty much brought an end to, I was very selfish and very single-minded about what I wanted to do. And I suppose I still am to some degree, but I've probably learned to bend a little bit as I've got older. You know, that's something which I guess, you know, an aspiring driver has to really make that decision, don't they, very early on, really, whether, if they haven't got that supportive partner, if they've got somebody in their life that isn't going to kind of give them that kind of, it's okay to do this, or it's okay to, you know, disappear for you, just like, you know, for 11 days or whatever, then perhaps that person's not going to be good for them if they want to achieve what they want to set out to achieve.
Yeah, it was a conscious thing for me. You talk about, you know, that side of things. It was conscious for me at the time when I moved across to England that I didn't want to get involved with girlfriends. And that was, some people you say selfish, and other people say, well, selfless. You go and make a right decision there, so you don't want to upset anybody else. And it was a long time before I did that. And it was a conscious thing, I think, at the time. I thought, okay, I don't need that distraction as such. I just want to go, and this is going to be my focus. I'm going to make a move. And that's what I'm talking about. The willing to sacrifice. There's certain things in your life you're going to have to, you know. In my case, I had to move out of home and to go to a different country to set up, you know, and do everything that you need to do. And from a financial point of view, of course, you're making a big jump as well. So that's the key with this part of it, Tony, is working out. Where is the value for you? You know, if everything goes absolutely brilliant, what would that look like? And also look at, you know, it's no harm in doing what I call a pre-mortem as well. So what would happen, you know, what's the worst case that can happen? So call it a risk analysis or whatever it's going to be. And how would you sort that out if that happened as well? So And there's got to be a you know, somewhere in the middle then that you'll base your projections on, you'll set your goals around. But you know, if you go in with the right attitude, you want to win everything, you want to make sure you're successful in everything, that's where you'll set your goal. But at the same time, you have to be mindful, you have to have some sort of a plan in place. If it doesn't go according to plan, you can move those goals. As I said, you know, goals aren't set in stone, they are flexible. There's only a guide at the end of the day. And that's what I wanted just to get across in this part.
I suppose, again, you know, we keep on making reference to the fact that how much does it cost? You know, we'll always refer to monetary, and then we've gone a little bit deeper very, very quickly. But I guess the monetary aspect very, very early on has to come into play as well. There has to be an element. And again, I can speak a little bit from personal experience, that once I'd made that kind of decision, and I had no aspirations other than to do, you know, I always kind of flippantly say I've overachieved. I never thought I would do round of the World Rally Championship and British Championship and stuff like that. That's not what I set out to do. I just set out to go rallying to the best of my ability, both financially and you know, with the best equipment I could possibly lay my hands on. You know, I very early doors, as I say, I managed to convince the company I was working for at the time to buy me a company car. So I didn't have to have a road car. So that wasn't a cost to me, even though I knew I was getting taxed, but, there wasn't, you know, that gave me more free cash. I didn't move out of home until I was about 30. You know, living at home is possibly the cheapest experience anybody, I think, can have. So I had this kind of I had an amount of money which I knew, without even beginning to look at sponsors, that I could funnel into rallying and to see where it would take me. And I think we spoke about this very, very early on when I went to VW. And, you know, I had nothing, but I said I had everything. And basically, I didn't. Basically, I had the money I was saving from not having a car and the money I was saving from still living at home. And that was all I had. And then I had to go out and generate the rest of it. But again, that's, I suppose, the sacrifice we talk about. Now, I suppose bringing in another element of it again is I was prepared to make that sacrifice, not because I felt I was the next Burns or the next McRae or the next Loeb or whatever, but I just wanted to do it to the very, very best of my ability. And I suppose that's another thing about, it's not, you know, we spoke about beliefs and things like that and limiting beliefs, but they kind of, that also comes hand in hand, I suppose, with how much will it cost? You know, what are you prepared to sacrifice to get to that point is where I'm getting to, I guess.
And it's all of the things that you talked about. You know, you've got what costs to run your car. You've changed it in the last year or so, and the costs have gone up when it comes to that. But you see it. You know, there's loads of, if you look at any entry list in Ireland, the number of Mark II Escorts and well over £100,000 worth. And the guys who are running those cars, you always have to go down to the disposable income, don't you? You know, it's all very well earning X amount, but when your costs are high anyway. And then whatever is left at the end of it is your disposable income, and that has to go towards family holidays and all the usual things that go around that. If you've got an understanding family, then that will help, of course. But yeah, it's a very selfish sport, I think, for most of the time, and there has to be a balance if you want a decent family life around that. And you know, that's your decision that you have to make, but you need to make it fairly early on before you start moving down the route of committing to expenditure. But, you know, it all sounds great. It's very rational, but as we know, rallying is very addictive. And there's a lot of people, I'm sure, over the years have lived well beyond their means to just win that next trophy or that pot.
It's very emotive, isn't it? I think that's the thing. And as you say, it's incredibly selfish when we think about it. And, you know, people talk about, we might actually cross swords on this one a little bit, but you know, people talk about, you know, finding the money to do it and stuff like that. You know, it's a very, you know, in the black and white of rallying, and you know, I've worked in circuit stuff and I still work in the circuit side of the business as well with race teams and stuff like that. You can kind of consciously see, you know, a budget in racing, because you've got the circuit and you've got the hospitality and you've got all the things that kind of come with it. Rallying, is very, very, very selfish, really, because a pal of mine, for instance, is a great example. You may remember, I can't remember who it was. Do you remember? And it was around the time you were doing BRC. There was an Evo doing it, and it was sponsored by Kitty Cat. And I can't think who it was.
Cat food, Kitty Cat.
Don't know. And it was on an Evo 6, I think it was, or something like that. But it was like that standing joke of us standing in the forest going, I haven't fed the cat. There's obviously so much more to it than that. But that's ultimately what people think kind of sponsorship of rally cars is, it's the name on the car. You and I both know ultimately that's really a bit of a nonsense. The name on the car is the receipt for the money, as far as I'm concerned. It's all the other things that kind of come with it. I've never sold it as the name on the car. But, it's a very, very difficult sell. When you compare it to going racing. And again, is this the bit where sometimes we are a little bit, blinkers on and stuff like that. And we almost feel a little bit frustrated that people don't get our passion. And I guess this is where the selfishness comes back in again. When I've spoke to several people involved in rallying, and I try to listen to it subjectively when they're selling it to me, because people try to sell to me as well with regards to sponsorship and things like that, and all I'm getting is name on the car, and they just think, no, you're not. You need to go away and rethink this pitch, because that's you being really, really selfish. And while you need to be that mindful and that selfish, you really need to think a little bit more outside of just that car going through a forest, because that's a nonsense. That's not going to help anybody.
Yeah, it's true. You think of sponsorship, you always hear chairman's wife syndrome, golf sponsorships, that type of thing. It's all about people who know people. The bottom line is it's just a networking thing in order to get to the people who, A, number one, have got an interest in motorsport. Number two, would have an interest in helping a driver progress. Number three, being involved in that journey and getting a kick from that. And once all of those things come together, from a clubman point of view, it's completely different, you're right. But you've got to look at it from the other person's shoes, and this is what I keep telling everybody. Most of what I do in any sales training is the biggest thing, is just put yourself in the person's shoes that you're selling to. It goes back to this same thing. People will not give you the money in their pocket or the money in their bank account unless they see more value and what it's worth to them in that bank account. So if there's something that's interesting, exciting, like going into a forest and bringing some of your mates there and having an adventure day out and being part of that whole side of things, then of course they're going to buy into it to a point. But there's absolutely no way that people will pay just to have their name on the car. That's basically just giving you money to go away. And if you go down that route, you're taking your £500, your £1,000 off people, and it's just, there you go, I'll help you out because you're a nice guy. You're not going to get any emotional involvement in it. We're quite happy to see their name maybe on the car if you win a trophy or whatever it is, but it's much more than that. But that's the way it's traditionally been sold, as you say, and you have to remember the people who are going out selling these sponsorships and trying to get people to help them. From a financial point of view, they don't have skills in that side of things, and that's not their fault. But my point is, in all of this and what we're looking at for these sessions that we've tagged on, it's all about learning those skills. This is what we talked about last week. If you don't really understand what selling is all about, there's plenty of books out there. If you just pick up one or two, the focus will always be on the person that you're selling to. So what's in it for them? What's the big idea? What's different about you? What's your USP? What are you, and these are the things that you can easily help people with if they want to learn. But going, the route that everybody's always done and doing it for the same way that everybody's done it, it just doesn't work. And we knew that many, many years ago. So,
There you go. So we've done more than what we normally do on these sections. So to wrap up on this one, Trev, with regards to the sacrifice and things like that, what would your final thoughts would be on it?
Well, it, for me, it just goes with what we've done before. So why do you want to rally is the first thing. So you get the big idea. Why? What's in it for you? What will make your life better by rallying? Then when you start to plan your goals, what do you want to do long term? From a financial point of view, of course, we know the limiting beliefs. If you planned it where there was no financial restraints, then that'll be it. Then we've looked at where the line in the sand is. We've picked up, in order to improve from where you are now to where you need to be, what knowledge, skills and attitudes are there. And then it links in, really. So what are you willing to sacrifice? You know, what do you want to do? And certainly if you're serious about it, at some point you're going to have to give up your work and you're going to have to go self-employed as a co-driver or as a driver or whatever it may be. So at what point are you going to make those sacrifices? You need to factor that in if you're making this a long-term plan, because if you don't do that now, you won't commit to it. If you don't commit to it, you'll half-heartedly do it. And that's not the right way to go about it. So once you've made all of that and you've worked out what's going to cost you, worked out what you're willing to sacrifice, and the next stage is to start listing the milestones or the mini goals to achieve that long-term goal, which is what we'll come back
to. Fantastic. Well, no, we'll be back in 2 weeks, but before we let you go, you subtly mentioned, but I did know it anyway, obviously, you've won Corsica and PWRC back with Martin Rowe. Now it is Corsica this coming weekend. If you could just give I don't even know what to call you anymore. I don't know whether we call you presenters and things like that on absolutely just pundits. Or in the game pundits. There you go. Out of all of us, you're the only one that's been competitively, and you're the only one that's won it. So I think you carry a little bit more weight than probably the three of us put together. And I don't mean that literally, obviously.
Yeah, well, we didn't actually win. All we needed to do was finish in the top five, but it was probably the most impressive drive from Martin Rowe that year. 2003 was the year, and you remember, it was quite apt seeing that Phil Mills is sitting in for Dan Barrett this time, and hopefully they won't have the issue and the shakedown that him and Petter had in 2003, but they certainly rebuilt that car, you remember, and went on to win the rally just ahead of us winning PWRC on the event. Yes, but to drive, on our occasion, to drive sort of 80%, 90% in really changeable conditions, and just hoping that you got through it. It was very impressive from Martin's point of view to have that approach and been able to get it home then. And yeah, the feeling, it's just a fantastic rally. But as a co-driver personally, I never really enjoyed tarmac rallies, certainly continental tarmac rallies, that much, because there's so little room for error. Anything that happens, the car starts sliding about, there's a wall on the outside or there's trees, and you just don't have room for error. And even though, you know, I've also done Corsica and a 206 World Rally car, and was set top five times there as well, beating Panizzi, which is quite good on one stage. But it's just no room for error, Tony, and I'd rather be sliding about in gravel than I would be on tarmac. But that's just a personal thing for me. But it's great to see, as I say, Phil Mills and Daniel Elena back at it again, from a co-driver point of view. So yeah, it's going to be great.
We'll talk
to
about that, obviously, when we all come back after our 2 week sabbatical. Folks, we have appreciated the downloads. We've got some more sections to do with the coaching next season as well, season 12. I hope you'll join us for that. And we do appreciate every single one of the downloads that you've gave us. As you do know, we have been running effectively unliveried this year. So far, we've got another season in the offering. We will probably be back for that other season, as I said. After that, it's going to be a tough old ask, but if you do want to get involved, please get in contact with us at studio@absoluterally.co.uk. By all means, you know where we live on Facebook. It's facebook.com/absoluterally. Twitter is absolute_rally, of course, and you can find that's where we all are as well. So if you want to get in contact with us individually, either Jack, Ryan, Trev, or myself, we're dead easy to find as well. So there you go. Listen, it's been great. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. We appreciate the download. Same time, same place, in your little podcast hole in 2 weeks' time.